This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow with a story that reads like a Graham Greene novel. The police chief of a thriving Chinese city jumps into his car and drives to a different city 4.5 hours away. He walks into the U.S. consulate and begs for political asylum. He says he has information about a British businessman found dead in his hotel room. The official cause of death? Alcohol poisoning. The police chief says it was cyanide, and he accuses the two most powerful people in the city, the party secretary and his wife. It is a tale dripping with opulence, corruption, sex, and violence, and while it may sound like a spy thriller, the true story was in fact picked up by American and worldwide press. And the details of the story first broke on a website called Boishun. The site is dense with links, its writing is in Chinese, and it's run out of an office just down the road from here in Durham. The man who created Boishun is Watson Meng, and he joins me today on The State of Things, along with Scott Savitt, a journalist who's covered China for a long time and does some translating for Boishun. Watson and Scott, welcome to The State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Watson, this is an epic story. It is filled with intrigue, and I hardly know where to start, but I think first we should tell our listeners who these characters are. First, Boishilai. He's a rising star on the Chinese political scene. Who is he?
Yeah, Boishilai, he has a very strong family background. He was supposed to be one of the Chinese leaders in the next few years. He has already have a very important position as a party leader of Chongqing City, one of the four biggest cities in China. So he's a very important person in China.
So he's an important guy in a very big city, the party leader, and he's legendary in terms of how he wields power and his persona in the city. Give us a sense of how this figure was perceived in China.
Yeah, he is perceived as one of the political star, and because he has been doing something either crazy or very shocking, because he... make Chongqing like something, you know, going back to Cultural Revolution.
That's the city that he is the party secretary in Chongqing,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And he's taking it back to the Cultural Revolution?
Yeah, because China has been perceived for as a, you know, reforming the country, going to be capitalism. But Chongqing is doing differently. So Chongqing, one thing they are doing is... the people singing the red songs, the songs in the Cultural Revolution in the Mao's time. Also, they are trying to give a lot of pressure to the business. You know, they put many business people in jail and different names. It looks like, you know, they are trying to something different, trying to go back to the old days of China.
But they're very successful. Chongqing is a successful and thriving city.
Not really.
Uh-huh.
It looks like the people, you know, the propaganda says the people happy, you know, they're trying to improve the life of the people. They pay attention to the average people and not paying attention to the rich people. Just like North Korea, you know.
Uh-huh.
They always say, you know, they care the people, but the result is the people are in very high poverty. But Chongqing, we did not see that poverty yet, but now after the fall of Boishilai, the people already see they waste so much money in propaganda, in crazy things, and now the city, you know, in need of investment from the central government. They cannot handle the, you know, deficit now. So,
well, let's talk about some of these crazy sins, including his reputation for ruthlessness and the way he spent his money.
Yeah, he's ruthless, not. The people did not recognize it until the incident in February. So after his fall, you know, a lot of corruption revealed.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the people realize he is not a so good guy.
Let's talk about that incident. He's doing pretty well. He's at least got a lot of people fooled, even if he's not bringing absolute wealth to his city. And then he's somehow connected with the death of a British businessman named Neil Haywood. Tell us the story.
Yeah. I think the death of the Haywood is one, I would say, not so big part of the whole story. the whole story, I think Boishelai and his supporters from the central government, they have a much bigger plan. So the Boishelai was not selected as one of the top Chinese leaders in China. I mean, not the number one. But he himself, he wants to be the number one. So they have a much larger plan. They try to block the way of the next selected Chinese leader. And then he has a plan to replace the next leader. So that's a very big, you know, very brief plan. So
how do we know about this plan? Is this something that observers had detected in his behavior, or was there real evidence that he was plotting to first get on the Politburo and then work his way up to number one?
You just mentioned Wang Lijun, the police chief, you know, went to the consulate. I think one thing Wang Lijun exposed to, reported to American consulate is the death of Haywood. But also, Wang Lijun was part of the plan with Boishelai.
And what was that plan?
The plan, very beginning of the part, is from the February of this year. They will launch a news media campaign against the next leader, Xi Jinping. So they will criticize Xi Jinping, use overseas media, and make the people think Xi Jinping is very bad. So if they fail to block Xi Jinping, you know, to be the next leader, and then, you know, they have the next two-year plan. So we don't know exactly what it will do, but, you know, obviously, you know, he wants to replace Xi Jinping.
And Scott Savage, yeah.
Yeah, so just a little elaboration. This autumn is the 18th National Communist Party Congress, and it's the leaders now, they've institutionalized. You get a five-year term. So the term of the present party secretary, Hu Jintao, is up, and Xi Jinping is the heir apparent. But he's the first leader in the People's Republic's history to not have been selected by one of the original revolutionaries. So Deng Xiaoping selected Jiang Zemin and Hu Jintao after him. So this is the sixth generation of leaders. And the only one, they weren't even born when the revolution happened. And so Boishelai's attitude is, why should this guy be in charge and not me? You know, I should be the leader of all of China. And I mean, speculative, sure. Watson is suggesting the U.S. government knows that, you know, this was intended. Certainly, circumstantially, it very much looks that way. And I'm in close contact with my reporter colleagues in Beijing every day. And this is the general consensus, is that's why this is such a sensitive topic. And I'd be curious to hear what Watson says about whether they intended to use the military to...
There was some indication, wasn't there, that there might be... This was more than a media campaign.
Yes.
Boishelai had a plan.
Yeah, that's plans after the media, if it did not work out. They have the plans for the next 2 years. One of the plans, I believe, they build up the secret military force. So it's very...
What is your information? How do you know that? And what points to the fact that he was planning to bring the military in?
In Chongqing...
That's the city.
Yeah, they have...
Everybody. That's the city.
Yeah. They acquired secretly 5,000 guns. So that's one of the information we have.
And he also went up and met with some military leaders in Chengdu, which is
Chengdu military.
Forgive me, and that's the provincial capital, right?
Yes,
which is 4.5 hours away,
yes.
And outside of his jurisdiction. So this meeting was somewhat mm-hmm. suspicious.
Yes.
So all of this, and then there is this, the police chief, who obviously had to be complicit. You don't get to be party chief of a big city like that without having a good relationship, let's say, with the mm-hmm. local constabulary. And that broke for some reason. Why does the police chief go to the suddenly turn on his boss?
Yeah. There are two versions. One version is in Chinese government media. Says Wang Lijun, because of Haywood case, Wang Lijun, talked to Boishelai, you know, criticize, basically, you know, not agree with the Bushelites because it's a Bushelite family issue. And Bushelite was angry, so this one, they, you know, they broke up. And our version is Wang Lijun was under investigation because of his corruption, you know, other crimes he committed from the central government. And so the investigation will be relevant to Bushelai. So this put Bushelai in danger. So Bushelai has at the moment want to cut off his relationship with Wang Lijun, even with more than Wang Lijun.
So the police chief realizes that his association with this guy who's now in the sights of the central government is not a healthy relationship. He better get out and turn states, talk about his relationship, or he's not safe. And the place, safe place to go might be the U.S. consulate.
Oh, yeah. Well, just add one thing is it's not even the local constabulary. He's been, you know, his hatchet man throughout his entire career. They've gone, you know, risen together. So both of them know where, you know, the bodies are buried. And which is why the latter explanation is the only one that makes sense, is he's not going to turn on his boss over the death of one British businessman.
It's a fascinating story, and we'll find out how the story came out of Durham and back to China and around the world when our program continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, and today we're talking about a story that gave us a singular glimpse into the political workings in China. The fall of Bushelai was reported recently in the Western press, but the story had been leaking out for some time on a website called Boishun. It's mainly aimed at Chinese readers, but it operates right here in Durham, North Carolina. With us is Watson Meng. He is the founder and editor of Boishun. Scott Savitt is a China reporter and a translator. He is also here. So I want to get back a little bit to this death of a British businessman and how it was first reported as alcohol poisoning, I believe, and later we found out that it was not. Tell us a little bit about who this businessman is.
Yeah, Haywood is an English businessman. He has a very close relationship with the Bushelai family. So we believe he has been helping Bushelai family to transfer, you know, billions of U.S. dollars to overseas. So he's deeply involved in the corruption of the family. So his death probably, you know, relevant to he knows so much about the family's corruption. So.
And that's when it turns out that it wasn't alcohol poisoning, but in fact cyanide. And that's what the police chief reports. So now this is all out. What happens to Bushelai? Where is he now?
We don't know. It's still a secret. You know, that's the people when criticize the system, you know, say, you know, if the officials, China does not have the right system, you know, the officials, right, not guaranteed. So we don't know where Bushelai, but obviously he does not have freedom now. So
he's off the scene completely. And he's certainly no longer in line for power. So that has changed. Let's talk about this story itself and your website, Boishun. Tell us how you started this site and what was the purpose originally.
Boishun was started in 2000, 12 years ago. It was started as the model of a citizen journalist. So basically, it is a very open platform for people to speak up or to report anything they see. So it has been 12 years. We can see it a very good model. So
started here. Why here in Durham?
I started this from New York when I was working in New York. But in 2003, I came here to study in Duke. So after I graduated, I did not go. I keep working and live here.
And why did you think it was important to start this kind of citizen website?
Because a citizen journalism, I would say, is always important, no matter in China or U.S. Citizen journalism, for example, has advantage in nowadays people around the people with a device, mobile device, cameras. If something happened even in the U.S., normally the traditional journalists will not be on the scene. Like when explosion happened in the subway, and most likely, you know, the non-regular citizens will have the photos. So that's a big advantage. But in China, it has more advantages because in China, has so much censorship and control that even the journalists, they have the time to go somewhere. It's restricted. Many things the journalists cannot report. So for the regular people, you know, the people see anything happen, they just, you know, put the picture on the internet. So that's part of, you know, all contents.
But you're not a journalist by training. You're an engineer.
Yeah, I was not trained as a journalist, but I care the society. The big mission, you know, what I did, I want, you know, it can be important to China. So China, basically, we don't have, even now in China, we don't have independent media. The websites like Boxing cannot exist in China. So I think it's important we have something outside China.
How is it perceived in China? There must be efforts to block and hack your site, right?
Yeah, it's a block. We receive attack from time to time. But I believe most people, if they see our website, they have very positive, you know, they like us. We are very popular in China. Many people like us.
So at the moment, then, you think it's still available?
Not. It's blocked. But the people find a way to use proxy or VPN. They come to see us. So.
Well, what about Scott Savitt? Let me ask you from the perspective of a Western journalist, how trustworthy is Boxing when you're really taking in? Maybe I'll start with you, Watson, and ask you how you vet the information. It comes to you. How do you fact check? How do you make sure it's accurate?
We receive many information, but we don't publish all of them. It's we receive a lot of stories on the ground, like something happened, you know, on the ground. For those stories, mostly we have the pictures, the videos. It's a picture or, you know, video. So that's, you know, mostly say like the pictures, you know, talks. And we do have some people working on the ground. So we have a long-time relationship. Those people regularly contribute to Boxing. We trust some of the, you know, dedicated reporters. So, and also like the story like Boxilai case. So for the years we developed the network, you know, certain things we go to different people to ask whether this is true or not. So we do have the verification. But we have a long history already, 12 years. At the beginning we could not verify all the information. But in current days I would say, you know, we do have a very good control over the quality.
And you have, since you began the website, won a Knight Fellowship in journalism that sent you to Harvard for a while, right?
In Stanford,
yeah. Yes. So your work has been recognized, at least in journalism circles, to win a Knight Fellowship.
Yes, I'm happy to see that, yes.
So Scott Savitt, again, as a Western journalist, how do you consume and then would you, you know, think about republishing anything you saw in Boxing?
That's a really good question, and it's very timely because I see both sides. You know, I pay close attention, being bilingual, so I read all the Chinese language information, but then you know, the Western English language mainstream media as well. And when the story broke, people were very skeptical at first because it was just it seemed too good to be true. But slowly but surely they said, oh wow, Boxing is for sure getting really reliable information on this. And it wasn't even you know, partially correct. It was completely correct. And in this China area, there are occasions where you have an impeccable source. You know, so I don't know if Watson is going to tell us who's feeding him this information, but it's most certainly someone from the very, very inside.
And we should say that since then, almost everything that began as a story or a rumor based on an anonymous source and some fact-checking has all been verified now by many independent sources, made its way into the Western press, right?
Yes, and regarding the source, you know, Scott asked, you know, who.
Yeah, that's absolutely, my next question, know, but go yeah, ahead.
But we, absolutely, we cannot, you know, yeah, say, you know, who. But the thing I can say is, you know, we have different sources. We trust the sources, so.
But in a story like this, one of the questions you have, so the first question is it accurate? And you mm-hmm. verify this. A couple of other sources comes to you. You say, yeah, yeah, this looks pretty good. You put it out. It's verified. And then the next question is, why are they telling me this? Is this a real effort on the part of individuals or the Chinese government in general to crack down on corruption? Or is this mm-hmm. just factional infighting, one gang getting rid of the top leader in another gang?
Yes, that's a good question. I think all the possibilities there. I think we cannot exclude, you know, the possibilities. But the consequence we can see is one part of the party fall. So that I believe the enemies or, you know, the competitors of Bo Xilai like to see that happen. So, but I don't know, you know, if that's planned or, you know, yeah, or does someone, you know, want to be this thing to be exposed? I don't know.
Give us an idea of where Bo Xilai is in terms of his ideology. You talked about him going back to Maoist traditions, singing songs mm-hmm. and organizing the city along those old style Maoist lines. Is he perceived as ideologically pure, or was that a kind of a charismatic tool that he used to win power? Does anybody know? And what's the analysis?
We can see different opinions, but some people say the politician, you know, he just want to use that image to get the position. But from what he has been doing, we believe he's more likely have the ideology. A few months ago, we did have one of the reports. The top leaders in Beijing, they had a meeting, and Bo Xilai spent 30 minutes talk about the Maoism, you know. And so others, you know, they kept silence. They found ridiculous, but they did not say anything. But the premier, Wen Jiabao, you know, laughed, you know.
All right, well,
and then he walked away.
But then this, and let me ask you first, Scott Savitt, whether or not this does is an insight then into some of the real tensions, the fact that Maoism and some of the old ideas are very much in play in terms of Chinese politics and the jostling that goes on, or is he a kind of one-time outlier?
No, it's very real, because the Chinese economy, if you see the news now, is going to run into some problems. All you hear about is this miraculous growth. Actually, it's been a product of a massive stimulus for years now, and the general consensus is it can't continue. The Chinese economy requires some rebalancing, and so people say, let's hark back. You know, at this point, a lot of people remember during Chairman Mao's time. I mean, even when I first went to China, I got ration coupons, and, you know, they were kind of like food stamps. You know, the free food is a good policy when people are having a hard time. So, and that's what he promised. He did build, it's called the Chongqing model. And so he built a lot of subsidized public housing. And, you know, he was considered to be campaigning for office for the first time in – this is something new in China, utilizing media. And he was probably succeeding a little too well for his comrades' tastes.
Is there any way to tell if that was, again, because just by dint of – you know, he's somebody who knows how to use power, knows how to use money, or is there something about the idea – that really has traction, do you think, among a good number of Chinese people? Any way to tell?
That's very hard to say. You know, we don't know exactly what in his mind, but we believe that's true. But that's important. But based on what he has been doing, is his work, you know, he's going that direction. So that's very dangerous to China.
But in terms of popular will, in terms of popular sentiment, is there mm-hmm. a sense that there is a growing kind of support for that kind of thinking?
I don't think so. He did receive some support, but I don't think that much, because he used so much propaganda some local people, they don't know the fact. Maybe, you know, in short term, they appreciate what he's doing. But in long term, especially the people, you know, can think. Right. They don't agree with him.
There is one aspect of Maoism, and that's fierce nationalism that will always be very popular in China. And that, I believe, was going to be and was his trump card. Let's go back to a time when China led the non-aligned, the third world, and really stood for something.
What is the central argument or the central tension among the leadership in China today? And, you know, what would distinguish one ideology from another, competing ideologies that really have traction?
Yeah. What we learn is China, the top leaders, they agree China is in a very difficult situation. China must change. They must reform. But there are two ways to reform. One part of, you know, we call it hard lines. They think the reform is still follows socialism. So, and, you know, on the base of socialism to reform. And the other part of the, you know, they think it's reform towards more Western democracy. Free market. So currently, we can see, is I would say, the good side has more favorable.
Is Boishun an exception in China? Or maybe the better way to ask the question is, are there more and more sites, more and more places where people can get access to this kind of information, or is the government becoming more successful in shutting you and others down?
The control, I don't think they will leave the control in the next, you know, 1 year or 2 years. But the people, have many ways to read Boishin, especially if Boishin publishes something important. The people inside China, if they get a piece of information, they will republish it in China in a few minutes. So that's, the blocking is not really very effective, I can see that. So.
How important is this story in China to the political structure? They've gotten one charismatic figure out of the way. Does it matter much to the structure? Did things change?
Yeah, it's very, very important. We will see that maybe in the next few years. But it's not only the fall of Boishilai. It's the Boishilai and the supporters of him, back him up from the central government. So if this did not happen, probably now we will see exactly two very different ideology. So China will have very good possibilities to go back. So that's the China absolutely will not be stable. We will see many things happen, and the political reform will be more difficult. So that's...
You think it's more difficult because of the fall of Boishilai?
No, because if he did not fall.
If he hadn't.
Even the business, one thing we can see, many businessmen will flee China. I have a very good friend from China. He came here a few weeks ago. He called me. He talked about the Boishilai case, and he did not know the connection between Boishilai case and the Boishun. So I told him the story, and then, you know, he told me, you know, if Boishilai got the power, he will leave China.
Yeah.
He's in a different city. Because he told me, you know, he heard many stories from Chongqing. It's very bad. So
in a lot of ways, it would seem to me that the central government should unblock you when you're telling that story. I mean, that story plays very well, this particular story that you covered, plays very well into their hands. They would be happy to see more stories about Boishilai.
Yeah, but, you know, Boishun has this story, also has so much information.
Are some of the other stories that you're covering?
So every day we have many civil rights, things happen, and if the people get abused by the government, we report those stories. Every day we have something, you know, important from central government almost. So.
And big news agencies are paying attention to you, I understand. BBC.
Yes, I heard that, yeah.
Yeah. What about you here in Durham? Do you ever feel threatened? personally?
I think U.S. is very safe, so yeah. I appreciate it. So.
Yeah. And the site itself, what's the future, do you think?
Yeah, I think it's we already verified it's a workable model, and we have a larger plan to make it more, larger and cover more areas. Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you both for being on the program today. Congratulations, by the way, on the fellowship a couple of years ago and on breaking the story.
Thank you very much.
Watson Meng is a founder of Boixin. Scott Savitt is a reporter working out of China for 18 years, and they both currently live in Durham. You can visit the site Boixin at boxun.com. And you will have to understand Chinese to read it. Coming up after a short break, a contemporary voice in African-American literature joins us. Stay tuned for author Tayari Jones on The State of Things. Stay tuned.